bone chilling greetings, everyone. The tunes are courtesy of Destined to Fail, Fading Point, and Stick the Landing. And I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from desert to ocean, from the Colorado Rockies to the Canadian Rockies, from tiny village to big city, and you guessed it, everything in between, it is greatly appreciated.
This week's city shout-out goes to
Allen, Texas, Oliphant, Pennsylvania, Accra, Ghana, Potomac, Maryland, Willingboro, New Jersey, and Plainfield, Indiana. Today, we continue on with the Rock or Death series. We are in part 10, and we have a whole new lineup. First up is Scott Puteski. Some may know him better as Daisy Berkowitz. Scott was actually a founding member of Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids. Born in Los Angeles, he was an avid music lover at a very young age. As a young child, he would play the snare drum and the flute, and by 15 years old, he was playing that guitar. Not only did he play multiple instruments, guitar would be his go-to, but he wrote music, and later on wrote his own lyrics with one of the several bands he would be involved with, that being Three Ton Gate. He would be the guitarist for Manson until his departure in 1996. Miami Herald talks about the beginning of that friendship between Brian Warner, a.k.a. Marilyn Manson, and Scott Puteski, a.k.a. Daisy Berkowitz, in an article dated back October 26, 2017, quote, Puteski's name isn't as well known as Marilyn Manson's, but if Puteski hadn't crossed paths with Brian Warner, the man who became the title character of the South Florida shock rock group, the world would never have met the Antichrist superstar. The two met in 1989, at the Reunion Room in Fort Lauderdale. Warner told Puteski of his vision for a rock band that would take the theatrics of acts like Kiss and Alice Cooper, but add a darker, gruesome, gothic twist. Together they created the concept by which each member took a stage name that would combine the first name of a female glamour figure with the surname of a serial killer, unquote. So speaking about the names, right, switching up names, Daisy Berkowitz was a mix of the model Daisy Duke and the Son of Sam serial killer David Berkowitz. Marilyn Manson was, of course, a mix of Marilyn Monroe and cult leader and killer Charles Manson. Other band member names included Twiggy Ramirez, Twiggy the model, and the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez. Gidget Gein was the model Gidget and killer Ed Gein. Madonna Wayne Gacy was singer Madonna and Pogo the Clown, serial killer John Wayne Gacy. And Olivia Newton-Bundy was, of course, for Olivia Newton-John and serial killer Ted Bundy. Scott would go on to do 9 albums with Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids. Some include Portrait of an American Family, Smells Like Children, and Antichrist Superstar. The latter would be his final album. Now, sadly, by the time Antichrist Superstar was in the works, Manson and Berkowitz, who were really close at one time and good friends, and the two co-founders, mind you, they really were not seeing eye to eye on anything, anything at all. You could point in the sky and it would be as blue as it could be, and you could say, look at that blue sky. No, I don't think so. It's kind of on the grayer side. And so it's decided that it's time for Daisy Berkowitz, Scott Futeski, to be no more, to be no longer part of the band, and to hit the pavement. You could go anywhere, but you cannot stay here. He would be gone before the album would be completed and released, but he was definitely a really big part of this particular album, Antichrist Superstar. And he had written the music for several of those songs, including the single Tourniquet. Now Scott, he would go on to sue Marilyn Manson for unpaid royalties, and that suit would privately be settled. He would also be awarded the rights to 21 unreleased recordings that he had done with the band. Greasy hands pulling on my sweater sleeve. You bite like a demon. So damn devilishly. Drown me in whiskey. Pour salt in the wound. Then whisper some bullshit about how I taste like the moon. Now, I found an interview Vice.com did with Berkowitz, and he shares some interesting stories with his time with Marilyn Manson and the band, and I wanted to share a few of those questions now. One of the questions asked was,
did the band blow up really quick?
And his response was, quicker than I thought it would. When we started out, we were just having fun. I didn't really plan on going anywhere, so to speak, commercially or financially, but our concept was together. We started promoting before we even played out. We had like 3 months in advance promotion for our very first show, which was not great, but we created a lot of awareness. A lot of people were aware of our name and were disgusted by our flyers. So I guess for our first 5 shows, we had a decent amount of people just out of curiosity. And when crowds started getting bigger, I was surprised. I didn't think anybody would be into it. We were filling a gap. We were doing something other bands weren't.
Tell me a crazy tour story.
Our bus broke down once in the middle of nowhere, a place called Two Guns, Arizona. Our driver got out and walked to this gas station that we could see in the distance. I couldn't tell how far away it was. It looked like a couple of miles. It looked like he had been walking all day. So we were hanging out in this spot and there was nothing to do. So we got out. I walked down this hill. And I found a cow carcass and its head and hooves were missing.
Oh dear God, how did that happen?
I don't know. That's another thing I'm afraid to look up. So I'm looking at this thing and then I hear a keyboard. Gingerfish, our drummer at the time, he's coming down the hill with my old Casio keyboard playing Summer Wind, Keep Moaning from Across the Sea. And I was like, am I tripping? I'm in the desert, but am I tripping? And anyway, the bus got fixed and we moved on. I was like, I'm going to remember this. It was really funny. I think that was the point when we started shaving our eyebrows off. And I remember that was in the Southwest that we started doing that. And Ginger was new in the band. He was the first one to do it. I did it after him, and it was like, oh, it is that easy. And one final question.
Why did you leave Marilyn Manson midway through Antichrist Superstar?
I think we're all curious, right? So his response was, I left because I wasn't getting the respect and appreciation and work I deserved. I did a lot of demos more or less a year before we started recording. When we started recording, I had about 10 or a dozen demos for Brian to listen to so we could develop something. I don't know if he listened to any of them, but he never wanted to work on any of them. We had a number of unreleased songs that were contenders for Antichrist that Brian didn't want to do or Trent didn't want to record. So I was being slowly muscled out as far as my contribution, and that's pretty much it. So in my opinion, that's really rough. You know, this guy, he's obviously talented. He is a co-founder for Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids. He has been working his keister off, obviously, and he does several songs, and he doesn't even know if they were listened to. And just being pushed out, that sucks, for sure. Poor guy. Deserved better than that. After leaving Manson, Puteski would be involved with several bands, including 3-Ton Gate, the Linda Blairs, Kill Miss Pretty, and the Daisy Kids. In late 1998, he would join Jack Off Jill, but that doesn't last too terribly long, as in 1999, he is no longer with them. Now, sadly, in September of 2013, Scott is diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer, and he battles that disease for a few years until his death in Boca Raton, Florida, on October 22nd, 2017. And at the time of his death, Scott Puteski, aka Daisy Berkowitz, was only 49 years old. Next up is Cliff Burton. He was Metallica's bassist until his untimely death. Born in Castro Valley, California, music was not only accepted in the Burton household, it was absolutely adored. It was a way of life. And at a very young age, Cliff takes up piano lessons. He changes direction and he says goodbye to the piano and he dedicates himself to being a bassist. Now, sadly, Burton and his family, they experienced deep, intense heartbreak early on when his older brother Scott dies due to a brain aneurysm. His late brother Scott played bass, and Cliff wanted to follow in his brother's footsteps. And in Cliff's own words, he said, "I'm going to be the best bassist for my brother." And that he was. He took this role very seriously in life, and he would practice several hours every single day. Even during his time with Metallica, he practiced every day. I'm sure his brother was ever so proud of him. While in high school, Cliff forms his very first band, Easy Street, named after a titty bar in the Bay Area. Gotta love it. Besides Easy Street and Metallica, he would be part of several other bands, including Agents of Misfortune, Trauma, and Spastic Children. Now, one fateful day in 1982, he was performing in Los Angeles when he catches the attention of two young men in the crowd, Lars Ulrich and James Hetfield, the founders of Metallica. I mean, come on, talk about being at the right place at the right time. Now, Metallica was still pretty new, just about a year or so. And at that specific time, Metallica, they were definitely in need of a bassist. And that day, as they watched Cliff Burton on stage, with amazement, the two rockers liked what they saw. Burton was perfect. They offer him the bassist slot in their band, and he happily accepts. And he is with Metallica until his untimely and unfortunate death a few short years later in 1986. The band he had been with had become, in his opinion, a bit too commercialized, and he was not happy with the direction they were going, and he was getting kind of sick of it. So he was really, really happy for the change. Boy, was Cliff ever so happy for the change. Together as a band, they would complete a couple of albums, Kill 'Em All and Ride the Lightning, but it was what happened next that was absolutely epic. Master of Puppets. He co-wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls, Orion, and Fade to Black. Have you ever heard of their album, Metal Up Your Ass? Me either. They had come up with that name, but it proved unpopular and no one really wanted that on their shelves. So Cliff approached his bandmates with the name that he had come up with himself, and it was called Kill 'Em All. And it was widely accepted, and not only that, but adored as well. Kill 'Em All. Yeah, yeah, yeah. With Master of Puppets coming out, they had been on tour promoting this particular album. No one had a clue of what horrific tragedy would unfold before their eyes during this tour. It's late September. It's the 26th day in 1986, and the band had just performed in Sweden. Things were going great. The crowds were huge. People were digging it. Things just really couldn't get any better. They were all set to perform next in Denmark, which had their driver pulling an all-nighter, driving the band to get there on time. So lead guitarist Kirk Hammett and bassist Cliff Burton, they were drawing cards to pick who would get the bed that Kirk had recently been using. And Cliff picks the Ace of Spades, and he wins the game. He chooses the bed, and Kirk's response, "Fine, take my bunk. I'll sleep up front. It's probably better anyway." Now they drive throughout the night, and it's now morning time, around 7 a.m., when suddenly the bus skids off the road. What happens next is a freak accident and something right out of a movie. Cliff Burton, he's sleeping on that bunk, right? He is not sitting down and buckled in, but he's fast asleep, which leaves him in a vulnerable and most unfortunate and, may I say, fatal spot. He is violently thrown out the window and the bus lands right on top of him, killing him instantly. I mean, I would really hope that he had no clue what was happening as he's being thrown out the window. I hope it was just like, you know, lights out. You're sleeping and you stayed asleep and that was it. I mean, so utterly heartbreaking. Rock'emWeb.com goes into detail about this horrific event that left Cliff Burton dead. Quote, "The vehicle slid, flipped, and landed on its side. With no safety restraints in the bunks, Cliff was violently thrown through a window. And then, as if fate were mocking the band's rise, the bus landed on top of him." The 24-year-old musician, who had just helped shape what many consider the greatest metal album of all time, was gone. Instantly. The other band members stood in disbelief. Hetfield said he saw Cliff's legs sticking out from under the wreckage. No one could speak. No one could process. The man who had brought intellect, melody, and heart to Metallica had been taken not on a battlefield, not on stage, but crushed under steel in the Swedish countryside, miles away from home. Cliff's body was cremated, and his ashes were scattered at Maxwell Ranch in California. At his memorial, Metallica played the instrumental Orion, one of Cliff's most personal and spiritual compositions, the haunting middle section of that song, often attributed to his soul and sensibility, now echoed as his farewell, unquote. So how could this have happened, right? How can a young, vibrant, healthy, happy-go-lucky man be here 1 second and dead at 24 years old the very next? The bus driver claimed that he had hit a patch of black ice. James Hetfield, he wasn't having it. He calls bullshit on that excuse right away. Hetfield himself would walk that road a good distance. Up and down, searching for the supposed black ice that killed his friend. The result? Not a damn thing. The road was dry. James was not the only one who had his doubts. The police searched for black ice, and they came up with nothing as well. A detective had shared that the tire tracks showed that he possibly fell asleep while driving, that he had seen those tracks in cases where, yes, the driver indeed dozed off. The driver denies this, Sadly, no charges would be brought up against the driver. Now, accidents happen all the time, right? And unfortunately, sometimes, yes, somebody does lose their life in the process. But to make some story up that is obviously bogus, black ice, it adds insult to injury. Hetfield, he shared that he thought the driver may have possibly been drunk. Whatever the case, the nameless driver gets off totally free. LouderSound.com goes into more detail about the fatal freak accident, sharing some of the reactions of his fellow Metallica friends and bandmates. Quote, understandably, the band have rarely spoken about the precise circumstances of tragedy. But more than 10 years later, on an excellent VH1 Behind the Music special, they finally spoke about the full horror of the incident. I heard everyone screaming except for Cliff, and I thought, oh my God, something's wrong, Hammett recalled in the documentary. I turned around and saw Cliff's legs sticking out from underneath the bus. While the band prayed for the survival of their friend, a crane was sent over to lift the bus. But just as Burton was about to be pulled from underneath, the chain slipped and the bus crashed back down on top of him again. If Cliff wasn't already dead, he almost certainly was now. There was nothing anyone could do except head for the hotel and the bar and proceed to try to hide the pain behind an alcoholic haze. After that, I was in such shock that I can't even remember the next 3 or 4 hours, Hammett said. I remember at 4 in the morning, I could hear James down on the street, drunk. He was screaming, Cliff! Cliff, where are you? And I just broke into tears. Now, PopCulture.com also mentions that day with details shared about the band. I saw the bus lying right on him. I saw his legs sticking out, and I freaked. Hetfield recalled of the incident in a past MTV interview. The bus driver, I recall, was trying to yank the blanket out from under him to use for other people. And I just went, don't fucking do that. I already wanted to kill the bus driver. I don't know if he was drunk or if he hit some ice. All I knew was he was driving and Cliff wasn't alive anymore. After his untimely death, Jason Newsted, formerly of Flotsam and Jetsam, took his place. He would be with Metallica for 14 years, but sadly, he was never truly accepted by the surviving members, and he was actually kind of bullied by them, which I love Metallica. I always have, but I really just hate bullying since I was a victim of that myself. So that was kind of a big letdown for me to hear that. While Jason may have not had a great experience with Metallica, he did have kind words to say about Cliff. He said, Cliff Burton was a bass god. He was a guru. He played bass like no one had before or ever will. People copy him, but no one has that inner drive. James Hetfield had this to say about his friend. Cliff had a unique personality and style. He was honest and totally musical. Cliff loved music. He was probably the only guy in the band who studied music properly. He took lessons. He learned theory and planted a harmony seed in me. I respected him completely because he had his own vision of how he wanted to be, and no one could fuck with that. Lars Ulrich shared this. It's not new that people in rock and roll die, but usually it's self-inflicted in terms of excessive drink or drug abuse, and he had nothing to do with it. It's just so useless. Completely useless. Metallica's former lead guitarist, Dave Mustaine, who after Metallica would go on to be the co-founder and frontman for Megadeth, while he may not have had many positive things to say about the band itself, Metallica, he had nothing but love for Cliff Burton. And I quote BassAsylum.com, the band's former lead guitarist, Dave Mustaine, who was by then replaced by Kirk Hammett, dedicated the song In My Darkest Hour to Cliff Burton. Despite his bad attitude towards other Metallica members, he considered Cliff his friend and a decent man. Many other musicians also respected Burton. His human qualities and performing skills made him an outstanding bass guitarist of his time. Anthrax and Metal Church released albums with tributes to Cliff Burton, unquote. Mustaine really enjoyed spending time with Burton. They listened to music and smoked pot, and he was devastated when he heard the news of the death, and he headed straight to Los Angeles, downtown area, and he was just crying his eyes out, and he bought some heroin, sadly, but he came up with In My Darkest Hour, and that obviously, again, is in memory of sweet Cliff Burton. Some of those lyrics include, "Through the darkest hour, your grace did not shine on me. Feels so cold, very cold. No one cares for me. I walk alone into the promised land. There's a better place for me, but it's far, far away. Everlasting life for me, in a perfect world, but I gotta die first. Please, God, send me on my way. Time has a way of taking time. Loneliness is not only felt by fools. Alone, I call to ease the pain." Cliff Burton is deeply missed in the music world. He was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2009. And a couple years later, in 2011, in Rolling Stone magazine, he would be recognized as one of the greatest bassists of all time. And February 10th, 2018, was declared Cliff Burton Day in Alameda County, California. A poem he wrote, which was in the song To Live Is to Die, reads this: "When a man lies, he murders some part of the world. These are the pale deaths which men miscall their lives. All this I cannot bear to witness any longer. Cannot the kingdom of salvation take me home?" Burton wrote this, and it would be read by Hetfield and featured in their album, And Justice for All, released 2 years after Burton's death. And to quote Cliff one final time, "You don't burn out from going too fast. You burn out from going too slow and getting bored." I would really like to think that as dedicated as Cliff Burton was, again, just religiously practicing and giving it his all, no shred of doubt whatsoever, that his brother, his late brother, is very proud of him. Next up in my rocker lineup is Jill Januszewski, better known as Jill Janis. She was the lead vocalist of a number of bands, including Chelsea Girls, Vexie Strut, The Starbreakers, and Huntress. The latter she formed herself and would be with them until her death. Now, growing up in the Catskills Mountains in New York, she had a deep passion for music. First starting off as a child singing opera, believe it or not, which is pretty neat. Then as a teen, she graduated into metal. Her musical resume is rather colorful. At the beginning of her musical career, she was a topless DJ using the name Penelope Tuesday. She also offered theatrical entertainment in the World Trade Center at the Windows of the World. Ironically, her last night working there was September 10th, 2001. Now, sadly, this young woman, she dealt with mental illness, major depression, and starting in her early childhood, she dealt with suicidal thoughts. Attempts had been made on her life by her own hands. Jill's very first known suicide attempt would take place at 16 years old In her own words, she was very suicidal. She says it turned into a full-blown mania and results in her suffering from memory loss. She said, "I lost my long-term memory and can't remember names, faces, or even places. We'll be at a venue on tour, and Blake, the guitarist, will be like, 'We've played here 2 times before, but I'll have no recollection.' My friends started to notice that I was developing these other personalities almost as protection. I was slowly not wanting to be who I was. That started to come into play at the age of 18 when I was going to music school in Manhattan." She was diagnosed as bipolar by age 20. In an interview with Revolver, which you can find on loudwire.com, she talks about her sickness. "I started to show signs of it when I was 13, though I struggled with it through high school. And it started to get dangerous in my early teens. By the time I was 20 and living in Manhattan, it was very, very difficult for me. That's when I was admitted into a mental health facility and was diagnosed bipolar with schizoaffective disorder, which progressed into schizophrenia and dissociative identity disorder." Now that's a lot for one person. You know, one of those alone is a lot, but all of those, it's just like, that's really heartbreaking. So as if this poor woman wasn't going through enough health issues, right? It gets worse, much worse. In 2015, Jill Janis experiences a lot of pain and bleeding in between periods and is diagnosed with early stage uterine cancer. She undergoes a hysterectomy, and thankfully after that, she is declared cancer-free. What a sigh of relief. What an absolute scare that must have been, though. I can't even imagine. "Wait, give me just 1 second. Give me like 2 minutes. Something's coming down upon the head. Too late, I keep thinking something about all of the things that I must do. In a different interview, this one with femmetalwebzine.net, Jill is asked about a specific song called Sorrow.
"Sorrow is a great way to start the record. I love the energy and the lyrics to that one. It seems very defiant and, despite the title, kind of uplifting. What can you tell us about that one?"
The lyrics for Sorrow are a reflection of me as an angsty teenager obsessed with death and Dracula. Most of the lyrics for Sorrow were written when I was 17. Quote, "Forever I'm your slave, chained to the wet lawn of your grave. Sorrow can't let go. I'm done with getting old. All I got is breath to hold. I wanted to write a melancholy thrasher with my sadness and fury entwining. We intentionally wrote with reverseprosody as the guide. I wanted a title to represent sadness while the music is all fury." So I listened to a part of that song and I liked it. I mean, you could tell that this gal was a spitfire gal who gave it her all, and she sang with such pride and passion. She had so much going for her, and she fought her demons for so long. It was a shame for what was to come. Tragedy strikes August 14th of 2018 when Jill Janis decides to end the battle she had been fighting most of her life, and she takes her own life, shaking the rock and metal music worlds to their inner core. The band she formed, Huntress, releases a statement on social media shortly after her death. "It is with crushed hearts that we announce that Jill Janis, frontwoman for the California heavy metal band Huntress, passed away on Tuesday, August 14th. A longtime sufferer of mental illness, she took her own life outside of Portland, Oregon. Janis spoke publicly about these challenges in hopes of guiding others to address and overcome their mental illness. Now, meanwhile, on Instagram, Hellstorm's front woman, Lizzie Hale, wrote this. It is with a heavy heart that we say goodbye to one of our peers. Jill Janis has died today. Jill was very open about her struggles with mental health and addiction. Now more than ever, spanning across every age group, the suicide rate is very high. I'd like to take a moment to state again how important it is to talk about mental health and remind all of you out there battling demons that you are not alone. I have to navigate my own dark labyrinth, and I turn to music and writing for my lifeline. I want to encourage you to keep searching for your lifeline, something that makes you happy. It doesn't matter if no one gets it but you. That's okay. We need to stop trying to live up to expectations that society places in front of us to make us feel unworthy of love, beauty, and success. We need to stop comparing ourselves to others. We need to stop trying to be normal. And we need to stop being quiet about our mental well-being. Asking for help doesn't mean you're broken. And if you don't know how to ask for help, that's okay too. Those of us who have a shoulder will let you lean on it. We are all in this life together. For those of you with the ability to lend a hand or ear, do it. We have a responsibility to help each other because everything we say, do, touch affects the whole race. We are all connected. And I'd like to address how careful we need to be with the prescription medications that doctors and people that we trust give us to try to fix us. Some side effects of these meds rewire your brain to where even if you wouldn't normally have suicidal thoughts, your brain actually starts thinking that it is logical, all due to meds. Please be careful, my loves. To Jill, my sister of Scream, I hope wherever you are, you have found the peace that you couldn't hear. My deepest sympathies go out to Jill's family and her band Huntress during this time. Lizzie brought up a good point about the meds, and I have to sigh at the end of any medical drug commercial when it talks about side effects. Anal leakage, blindness, severe migraines, suicidal thoughts, yada, 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 yada. I'm surprised it doesn't say your arm might fall off. The list goes on. Now, I experienced several years ago major heartbreak when a dear family friend committed suicide. He was one of the happiest guys that I ever knew. He was the guy that literally would walk into the room and his smile and laugh and even just his voice, his happiness, it was contagious. Well, one day out of nowhere, his fiance breaks things off, leaving the man totally devastated. He goes into a deep depression. But he goes on antidepressants and continues on with life after being dumped. He notices that the particular drug he was prescribed was making him feel not only even more depressed, but leaving him with suicidal thoughts. Never in his life has this man ever had a second of thinking of suicide. Never. His fiance left him. Yeah, that really sucks. But guess what? He would never kill himself. He had a child who was his everything, and he was a beloved figure in the community, very well respected. He even had talked to my dad and uncle about a possible opportunity in something, and he was super excited about that. Yeah, he no longer had his lady, but his future looked bright, and he was happy. Well, he shared his concerns with his doctor, sharing that he is having thoughts of killing himself and that it really scared him, actually it terrified him. And I'm not a doctor, but if I was and my patient came up to me with these concerns, I would stop that medication at once and look into something else for them, another alternative. Well, this nutball pathetic excuse for a doctor who I pray no longer has a medical license because who knows how many other people have died, he did not do this. He would end up doubling up the prescription. And the end result, my friends, he shot himself. Now, I don't know if any doctors or nurses or anybody, if you're listening, but would you do that? I just, to me, it's insane. Fucking insane. So I must echo Lizzie Hale's words, be careful. If you are on something and you start to get these demented thoughts of suicide or experience other disturbing side effects, please go to your doctor. And if they're a nutball like this one and doubles the dosage, please just stop doing it. That's insane. Your life is precious. Jill Janis's life was precious. My friend's life was precious. Have you lost a person you love to suicide? Well, their life was precious too. Now, during her time with suicide, Jill Janis would seek help, not only with Suicide Hotline that I have given oh so many times, which is 1-800-273-8255, but also she would go to a company known as To Write Love on Her Arms. And it's a nonprofit founded in 2006 in Florida and is not just for suicide, but also for addiction and other things as well. At the time of her death, Jill Janis was only 43 years old. Each person I talked about today was loved, respected, and simply adored by family, friends, and of course the fans, the countless fans. And may every one of these precious souls rest in peace.
That concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all spectacular. Haven't heard every single one yet? You can binge listen to your heart's fright and delight by hitting up any of those fantastic podcast platforms such as Deezer, Blueberry, Spotify, iTunes, Downcast. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks for stopping by, and
I will see you next week. Yeah, yeah, yeah.